Slack, the messaging app for work, took an official step to list shares on the stock market. The company said Monday it had confidentially applied with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission to list shares, and a source tells Reuters it's pursuing an unusual direct listing. Reuters previously reported that Slack is hoping for a valuation of $10 billion.
The effects of the longest shutdown in American history has yet to be fully tabulated. The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office estimates the shutdown subtracted $3 billion from the U.S. economy. The monthly hiring numbers out for January not showing much of a negative impact besides an uptick in unemployment to a seven-month high. But that may not be telling the whole story. A more updated read on the labor market are weekly claims for unemployment benefits. And for the last week of January, unemployment claims surged to a one-and-a-half-year high.
As GM negotiates to invest nearly $3 billion in Brazil, here in the U.S., it'll reportedly begin laying off employees on Monday. The Detroit News reports that the U.S. automaker will begin laying off about 4,250 salaried employees. It cites a source saying that GM will largely complete its ongoing drive to cut some 8,000 salaried and contract jobs this month.
Now, WGN Radio's Daily Conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the program. Today is Tuesday. It's February 5th, and it's 5:10 in the morning. Thank you for tuning in for another edition of The Opening Bell and another business day getting underway. We've put together a really good broadcast for you today. Catherine Newman is here, the author of Downhill From Here, Retirement Insecurity in the Age of Inequality. Catherine will join us quickly here this morning in our first segment. We'll talk a little bit about her book and the problems and solutions of retirement today in our world for all ages. And a little bit later in the program, Johnny Taylor Jr. will be here. He's the CEO of the Society for Human Resource Management. We'll have a conversation about the First Step Act, hiring ex-offenders, and the positives and negatives surrounding that. So that's coming up at about 5:40. First, let's begin on the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk. The opening bell rings this morning after tech shares and corporate earnings sent stocks higher on Wall Street yesterday. Shares of Apple, Facebook, Amazon, and Google parent Alphabet all traded around 1% higher. This morning, futures are pointing toward opening gains when the opening bell rings. The Dow, NASDAQ, and S&P futures are up anywhere from 0.25% to 1/3 on the Dow this morning. Dow futures up about 76 points. In Europe, markets are all in the green. In London, France, and in Germany, London up more than 0.25%, and in Germany up more than 1%, nearly 1% in France. And in Asia, where the holidays there continue, the Shanghai Exchange and the Hong Kong Exchange are closed because of the Lunar New Year. But the Nikkei is going to finish the day down nearly 0.25% off of nearly 39 points. And oil in the U.S. is trading at $55.07 a barrel, which is up about 51 cents. The focus in growth on the private sector and services industries will be focus front and center this morning with the economic reports list. The Purchasing Managers Index for January is out. There could also be some reaction today to the Federal Reserve's Chairman Jerome Powell having dinner with President Trump last night. Powell told the president the central bank will remain non-political. The two had dinner at the White House, where Powell told Trump that monetary policy would be crafted to support maximum unemployment and stable prices. Powell, who was appointed by Trump, has been a frequent target of criticism on the part of the president. Trump has expressed his displeasure over recent months whether the Fed has raised interest rates properly. The Fed Vice Chairman Richard Clarida and Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin were also at the dinner to talk about the economic outlook. Google's parent company Alphabet reporting better than expected earnings for the latest quarter, its latest quarter. Alphabet's quarterly report shows the company earned more than $39 billion in revenue against estimates that it wouldn't quite reach the $39 billion mark. Much of that revenue came from the company's advertising business. Despite the good earnings report, shares of the company fell in after-hours trading over worries about an increase in the company's spending. front and center this morning. We talked a little bit about retirement. The state of retirement in America is said to be little short of a disaster, according to our first guest. Sociologist and author Catherine Newman says it's being made worse by economic inequality. The author of Downhill From Here, Retirement Insecurity in the Age of Inequality, joins us now on the telephone. Catherine, good morning. I want to begin with just how bad the situation is, the retirement situation is. Give our listeners a sense of how bad it is.
It's terrible. In short, we have millions of people with virtually no resources for retirement. 62% of African Americans, almost an equal amount of Hispanics, have nothing at all in the way of employer pension benefits. A very large number of people are going to have to depend on measly 401k plans in which they have very little money. We're living longer, which is a blessing and a benefit, but Social Security replacement rates are significantly down as a result. And we've got more and more pension programs that are in trouble financially, both in the private sector and in the public sector. When you put all that together with wobbly housing equity, which many people experienced after the Great Recession, and in some places have still not recovered, we have a recipe for some very significant problems, especially when coupled with increasing health costs.
And so what, I mean, I hate using the phrase recipe for disaster or even the perfect storm, but it feels like that's what's coming.
That's what's coming, and not only for the generation that is currently looking at retirement, but for the generations coming behind them, for Gen X, for millennials. I don't think it looks any better. If anything, it may look much worse because their assets are significantly less than the generation ahead of them. They had a wobbling entry into the labor market. They never had real pensions. They only had the 401k system. And you put all that together, and I think this is at least as much a problem for future generations of retirees as it is for the people who are looking at it now.
Yeah, and let's go through a couple of those generations. First of all, let's talk about the generation that's working now. You've got people who are in unions who should have good pensions that don't really have those anymore. You have the Gen X crowd who's riddled with debt, who has so much debt. 38%, I believe, is one figure I saw of what they have in debt versus savings. And then millennials coming up, too, that are saddled with all of the student loan debt.
That's right. It's not a good picture. And for the millennials, the rise of the gig economy created an even weaker benefit sector than what was there for the Gen X generation, who were in turn not as well off as the baby boomers. The union density has declined precipitously, and with it went the only real solid pensions that the country's ever seen, the so-called defined benefit pensions. Those barely cover anybody anymore. So what we have in the way of a pension so-called system, in air quotes, isn't much of a system anymore. And as a result, people are working much longer. The fastest growing category of American workers is now full-time workers over the age of 65. And that's because they can't afford to retire. So this is not a very sustainable recipe.
The part of this is that you mentioned there are older folks who are working into their retirement. What kind of numbers do you have on that? How significant is that? And are we headed back to a time where we have so much old age poverty that it just becomes a crisis?
Well, you know, we thought we solved old age poverty with Social Security. And honestly, Social Security did a pretty good job at that. But it's arising now. Old age poverty is rising now because Social Security isn't strong enough. Its coverage is reasonably good, but the amount of money is, or the so-called replacement rate, is not as strong as it needs to be. That could be fixed by lifting the Social Security cap, and that has been proposed recently, and that needs to pass. Because if we did, it would at least shore up Social Security. We also need to be sure that pensioners, people who are, you know, in line to receive pensions, are treated as respectfully as creditors as any other creditor for firms that are wobbling and going into bankruptcy. In fact, what's happened is that pensioners have just been set aside and their benefits wiped out, or their plans have been raided for the cash that they represented during the boom years in the stock market. And the same thing has happened in the public sector. We've got cities like Detroit, out your way, that have wobbled badly, gone into bankruptcy, and cut their pension benefits, entirely eliminated retiree health care, and left people, especially before they were able to qualify for Medicare, really in the worst possible position.
On the Social Security front, is there a fix for that? I know some people always predict the worst when it comes to Social Security, that it may not be around in 10 or 20 years or 30 years. Is that a fixable problem, part of the problem?
Yes, I think that is an easily fixable problem. All we have to do is ensure that people who have been as fortunate as I have, who are reasonably high earners, to pay on their full earnings, to pay full Social Security tax on their earnings. Right now, Social Security tax stops at about $130,000 a year, I believe. But if we lifted that cap and just applied exactly the same rates to all earned income, we wouldn't have a Social Security problem. We would be into it forever, and that's what we need to do.
What are some of the other solutions here? You mentioned a couple of things earlier, the 401k issue, health care is contributing to some of the cost of health care. What are some of the solutions, other solutions?
Well, I think we need to recreate the kind of retirement system that where the savings can't be touched. I mean, that's essentially what Social Security is, and it's what the defined benefit pension system used to require. The problem with 401ks is it's eminently touchable, and that's what people did during the Great Recession. They pulled money out, and as a result have just used it essentially like an ordinary savings account. Retirement cannot be used as an ordinary savings account. It really has to be a kind of sacred savings. And that's what it is the worldwide in more solvent Social Security systems and pension systems than ours. So we're going to have to get serious about that. We're going to have stronger employer contributions to retirement. We have to understand that retirement is a social benefit that we agreed to 50, 60, 70 years ago when we decided that that's what a civilized country should do to provide for people in their old age. We are going to have to bend the health care cost curve, and that requires a lot of investment in efficiency in health care. But I think these are all things that are doable. I believe that because other countries have done it. There are other countries that are also aging have found better ways to provide that coverage, and we need to look to them.
Let's talk about that for a little bit, because I know you're right about it, this social contract with seniors. The other countries that are doing it better, how have they done it?
Well, in part, they put more of their GDP into retirement, and they insist that it stays there. So there's a higher contribution of the general tax revenue to retirement. They do require people to work longer, as do we now with increasing the Social Security age of recipiency. But mostly they just put more money into it, and they pay higher taxes for it. Now, that, of course, is quite controversial. Americans hate to talk about raising taxes. But if in exchange they got real security, one wonders if that would be quite as controversial as it feels now. I think, unfortunately, the faith that it will be there for them is part of what has contributed to that anti-tax sentiment.
I want to talk about the inequality part of this. How is that exacerbating the retirement part of the equation?
Well, when we look at who really struggles in retirement, it's completely related to what they were doing when they were in prime working years. So when you look at people at the bottom of an unequal economy, they tend to be in jobs that are part-time, undesired part-time. They'd rather be full-time. And have no benefits. There is no pension if you work for McDonald's or you work for many low-wage health care providers or any of the other service industry jobs at the bottom. For the most part, those are jobs that don't come with any kind of retirement planning. So as you move up the chain and you find workers that are more and more affluent, you start to see much stronger benefits. And, of course, in the earlier years when unions were strong, working-class people had strong pension benefits because the unions were there to bargain for them. Our retirement system unraveled for the working class and the middle class, largely consistent with union density, because the original defined pension benefit plans were entirely union bargained, and as unions disappeared, so did those plans. Not everywhere. If you look at places like Las Vegas, interestingly enough, where you have extremely strong union density, you still see these very generous pension plans.
Catherine, we used to always hear about hopes for our golden years. You don't hear a lot of people talking about golden years anymore. It's almost become a joke, hasn't it?
I think only for people who are quite wealthy is that still a reality. For everyone else, those older years are working years now.
Catherine, thank you for being with us this morning. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Sociologist Catherine Newman with us, the author of Downhill from Here, Retirement Insecurity in the Age of Inequality from Macmillan Publishers. Newman also formerly of John Hopkins, Harvard, and Princeton, currently the Senior Vice President for Academic Affairs at the University of Massachusetts System. Again, the book Downhill from Here, Retirement Insecurity in the Age of Inequality.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning again, everyone. Welcome back to the program. Thanks for being here with us on our Tuesday edition of The Opening Bell. Big companies like IBM, Walmart, and trade organizations like the National Restaurant Association and the National Retail Association, along with the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, have committed to change their recruiting practices to include those with criminal backgrounds. Johnny C. Taylor Jr. is president and CEO of the Society for Human Resource Management and joins us this morning here on The Opening Bell. Johnny, good morning. Welcome.
Good morning, Steve. How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you. How are you?
I'm doing well. Glad, I must say, I love Chicago, but I'm so glad not to be there. You all are cold this morning.
Yeah, and it's gonna be icy. We just got rid of the snow, and now some ice is on the way. But hey, that's winter, right?
That's right. Yeah. Call it that. Thank you for having us this morning.
Well, this is a very cool topic, and I'm curious right off the top, is the movement forward on this being driven by the tight job market, or is there really a change in thinking here among companies and organizations about hiring ex-offenders?
Well, I think it's a combination of the two. There's no doubt that a hot economy and low unemployment and, frankly, the addition of the lower birth rate over the last decade or two has led to that perfect storm where people have been forced to think honestly about where are all of the untapped pools of talent, one of which is those who've been formerly incarcerated. So I think it's a little bit of a sort of cultural shift, but there's no doubt that it's prompted by the larger macroeconomic issues.
Talk to us a little bit about the numbers involved. Who are we talking about here? Because there are all kinds of statistics about who is currently behind bars, how many have left prison and served their sentences. There are quite a few working adults here, aren't there, to talk about?
That's right. So what we know is that roughly one in three Americans have an arrest record. So start with that, and that's the beginning of a problem. Even if you're not currently incarcerated, when one goes to apply, you're oftentimes asked, do you have an arrest record or have you been incarcerated? Obviously, people who are currently incarcerated aren't applying for jobs. So it starts with that. But one-third of adults in America have some type of arrest record. That's number one. But those who are incarcerated, about 700,000 people per year are released from incarceration in the United States every year. And so that's a huge population, particularly given that we have, you know, depend upon the numbers that you hear, a million or so jobs that go unfilled currently because we don't have the talent to fill them. So that's you know, the numbers are significant. A million people and, you know, a million employers looking for employees and 700,000 plus people coming out of jail every year. That means there has to be some opportunity for both sides to benefit and gain from this.
So the companies that are involved so far and these associations that I mentioned off the top, changing how they do things here, their recruiting practices, what is changing in that process?
Well, first of all, a heightened sensitivity and awareness of this untapped pool of talent. Sherm talks about that a lot. You know, in the context of diversity, we oftentimes talk about hiring people who we wouldn't otherwise think about hiring, and actually seeking them out as opposed to passively waiting for them to come and seek employment with you. In this market, employers don't have the luxury of doing that. So one of the things that we cover in the pledge and in our toolkit, the Sherm toolkit, is how to go about recruiting people who are formerly incarcerated. And that's one of the things that they're doing is employers have to think about, what do I need to affirmatively do to find that population? And then when we get them, how do we make them feel included in the workplace?
And part of this, too, has to deal with, you know, workers who are going out looking for jobs who have the criminal record, having a more welcoming arrival at a job. You want workers to be honest, but you also have the employer side of this. Talk to us a little bit about that interaction, that process, how that might be changing.
So what the toolkit, the SHRM toolkit, would help employers do is understand how to, one, train their hiring managers and HR managers, for that matter, on, you know, how to respond when someone says, I have a criminal record. How to, you know, not freak them out because they already know, they walk in realizing that this is negative, but how to make that a positive and how to get them to talk about it so that we go into this potential working relationship with a level of honesty. And that's the beginning of that, and that takes a lot of training on both sides. Particularly from the employer, because we all conjure up these ideas of what someone who's been in jail looks like and how they talk and what they think. And so we have to demystify, if you will, the potential candidate in front of us, and that requires training and a cultural shift. So that's part of what we have to do. And then, as you pointed out, employers have an obligation to ensure that as you onboard this person and bring them into the organization, that the organization, if in fact someone learns, because you've got about learns of their criminal background. The one thing we can't do is, while most companies don't announce that someone, we're hiring someone with a criminal background, at the end of the day, most of their criminal records are public. So we have to ensure that the organization knows how to deal with employees and makes them feel welcome and you know, included in the workplace.
There's some research available, too, here about what hiring managers and HR people are saying about the quality of the hire of workers with criminal records. And it may be surprising to some, but more than 80% of the managers found that these hires were just as good as somebody without a criminal record.
No, it's amazing. And that's really the most compelling argument is, you know, one can respond to what they think and what they, you know, their perception. But the reality is, as you pointed out, the research says 80% of our managers are saying, when I hire someone with a criminal record, they are not performing from a quality and productivity standpoint less than the people who don't have criminal records. And one of the most significant and compelling sort of stats is that overwhelmingly they retain longer. In other words, when they come work for you, you don't have to worry about them job hopping as much as you would people who don't have records, because I think they are so satisfied and pleased that someone gave them an opportunity that they're much more loyal in the workplace.
You know, the bigger problem here, Johnny, and you know this all too well, is if we're not going to rehire and give a second chance to people who've been behind bars, they're likely to go back, aren't they?
Well, that's really the most compelling of all of the arguments. Whether one believes this in their heart or not, at the end of the day, as taxpayers, as citizens, we want to do everything that we can to keep people from returning to the criminal justice system. And the reality is, no matter how, you know, rehabilitated and well-intended an individual might be, if they come out and they don't have any ability to earn an honest living, then they are absolutely quite likely to return to the criminal justice system. And that costs us all, because we as taxpayers then have to support them. So this is just smart business from an employer's perspective. We get talent. We also, you know, as taxpayers, have the opportunity to bring people back into sort of our society in a meaningful and productive way. So it's good for everyone, and positive self-esteem to the individual who has committed crimes in the past and now wants to live right and go forward and be a productive citizen.
And what you're doing there, and some of these organizations and companies have got the ball rolling on this. How does the First Step Act play into this?
Well, it was significant. You know, Congress and the President signed in December the First Step Act, and we as employers thought, okay, then what's the next step? So having a law is interesting, but ultimately we need to move behavior, and we need to help people know how to go about moving that behavior. And thus, SHRM decided to, you know, launch this pledge, and the pledge is called the Getting Talent Back to Work Pledge, and you can find it at gettingtalentbacktowork.com. And the opportunity, so even if Congress has said these are the things that you should do, and employers say, and we want to do it, what SHRM realized is that a number of them don't know how to do it properly. So we then launched this initiative with a toolkit so that we could help people do what they want to do.
So what's the next step here? I'm guessing you probably want to get more businesses involved, some more big-name people behind this?
Well, yes. So, in fact, that's the goal. The goal now is, now that we have legislation in the First Step Act and we now have the Getting Talent Back to Work pledge, we want to ensure that employers know how to, hiring managers know how to hire and retain these employees. And now we're going out asking everyone everyone who's a manager, if it's a small company, medium-sized Chicago company, large company, to go to the website, get to know more about it and how to do it, and then sign the pledge.
And two, you know, I guess the next step of this is workers, we have to kind of have a different mindset as well, don't we? I mean, if we're going to share our workplace with people with criminal backgrounds, former criminal backgrounds, what's the advice for the workforce?
Well, so see, that's really interesting because you're spot on. One of the most significant challenges for us is not the hiring managers sometimes, and not HR for sure, it's oftentimes other employees. Our research tells us that there is a lot of hesitation. When you ask people, they say, sure, I think you should hire the formerly incarcerated and give them a second chance, just not to sit next to me. And so it's the not in my backyard or the NIMBY phenomena. And so it's something that we're working on, and that's why it's so critical. And we talk about it in the toolkit, the Getting Talent Back to Work toolkit. We talk a lot about how organizations can make this a part of their culture so that when employees do come in, they're accepted, and the other employees are not, essentially telling them, we don't want you here, although management does.
Johnny, this is good stuff. We appreciate you being on with us this morning and talking about this, and we'll direct people over to the website and try to get more people involved in this, and please come back and join us sometime.
Well, I appreciate you, Steve, and I hope Chicago commits to signing the Getting Talent Back to Work pledge, because we all have a vested interest in this working.
All right. Thank you. Have a great day.
You too.
Johnny Taylor, Jr. is president and CEO of the Society for Human Resource Management. I can direct you to their website. Again, it's gettingtalentbacktowork.org. gettingtalentbacktowork.org.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
On the WGN Associated Bank Market, DAS futures are pointing toward opening gains on Wall Street. The Dow futures up 82 points, nearly a third of a percent. S&P and NASDAQ futures higher by about a quarter of a percent. Now, agriculture and commodities. Good morning, Orion Samuelson.
Good morning, Steve. The soybean market moved a little bit higher at the Board of Trade yesterday, thanks to renewed Chinese demand for U.S. soybeans and continuing concerns about a smaller Brazilian soybean crop because of the weather. The March soybean contract gained just 0.75 cents a bushel. March corn up a penny a bushel. March wheat up a penny and a half a bushel. And in livestock trade yesterday, cattle futures were higher on technical buying. The March feeder cattle contract up $1.70 a hundredweight, and the April live cattle contract up 72 cents a hundredweight in yesterday's trade at the Mercantile Exchange. In the corn world in the U.S. yesterday, attention focused on the Bud Light commercial in the Super Bowl on Sunday night. A commercial that kept saying, without any explanation, no corn oil included in our product. Didn't tell us why. Didn't tell us why it's good or bad. But Mark Recker, the chairman of the Iowa Corn Growers, said, please leave us out of the beer wars. Support your local corn farmers by standing with us and choosing products that include corn. He said this after pointing out that corn is used in over 4,000 everyday products, from corn-fed beef to ethanol to bourbon and to makeup. Interesting concept that just raised a question of why. Have a great day. I'm Orion Samuelson.
Thanks, Orion. You as well. Now the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk outlook for Tuesday, February 5th. The focus is on growth in the private sector services industry this morning. The U.S. Purchasing Managers Index for January forecast to show a modest pullback from December's survey. The PMI Services Index due out at mid-morning. The Institute of Supply Management will be out with its report today as well. Analysts say the ISM Index also will show a slight softening from December. Also on the calendar today, it's State of the Union Address Day. Tonight on Capitol Hill, also earnings today from Disney, Snap, and Electronic Arts. Just some of the things that could move the markets on this Tuesday, February 5th.